Senate gavel now. Uh-oh. I just thought I had it flipped upside down, though. Too much for a gavel. But this will be passed down from Senate chair to Senate chair, so that from now on out, Senate chairs will not have to slam books and or hands against the podium. So let's go ahead and bring the meeting to order, the second Senate meeting for this particular academic year. Let's go ahead and the agenda, by the way, posted online. Hopefully everybody saw that. Don't forget to sign in. That is at the back table. Once again, just a quick announcement as far as seating arrangements. If you weren't here last time, please have all senators at the tables, and then anyone else, any visitors, sitting in the other locations. So just a reminder about that. Let's go ahead and see if we can get a motion to approve the September meeting minutes as posted. And thank you very much. Any discussion? All right. All those in favor of approval of the September meeting minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. Meeting minutes are approved as posted. On to reports. I don't have anything for you in particular at this time. We do have some information items, and so I'll get into some information a little bit later on in terms of the SEC meeting. Most of those things are from the SEC meeting, so I'll talk to you a little bit more about that as we get there. Jennifer, I believe you have a couple of things for us.
I'm still collecting names for department heads for candidates for the tenure and promotion and reinstatement. I thank the department heads here who have been so cooperative and want to set the timeline. We're trying to be able to do the draw today, but we're still waiting for a number of people to come in. We should have the names in by November 1st. And thank you. Also, Chancellor Ray of the Glasgow campus has asked me to make an announcement and to invite you all to attend the WKU Glasgow's first university-sponsored open house being held on November 7th from 5 to 7 p.m. and concurrent departments to have shown here. We're pretty excited to have this opportunity. If you have any questions, please feel free to email Dr. Sally Ray. I know she will come here. So, other than that,
all right. Thank you very much, Jennifer. Heidi, anything to report?
The sign-in process is to put a line through your name. And if you are a sub, write your name to the right of the person you're subbing for. Thanks.
All right. Thank you very much, Heidi. Molly.
I do not have a report because we don't have it prepared yet. We'll begin me 2 weeks ago.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate that. And then under the advisory agenda, the order for that, Dr. Emsley, who has just arrived, has asked if he could go ahead and go first. So I have of course checked with President Ransdell to make sure that that was acceptable. So so Dr. Emsley, go ahead and please present your report.
Okay, well, thank you.
Yeah, I have to introduce a speaker at 5 o'clock. I want to make sure that I got this thing. 10 recommendations submitted from the Senate at its last meeting, all approved. 1 and 2 from the Graduate Council. And number 3 on the creation of the UC 100 course, which I'm delighted to inform the Senate has a triple-digit enrollment of students. That's a college prep course. 04 on culinary courses. 05 and the policy for dean selection and review. Policy 06 on faculty-led study abroad compensation, making that now the same as a summer course. Policy 7 on department head selection review. Policy 8 on the definition of the credit hour, essentially now including a regularly scheduled class period during finals week is counting toward the contact hours required to meet the SACS accreditation principle. Policy 9 on priority registration will be in effect for the registration that's about to occur for the spring 14 classes, and that essentially creates two tiers of priority registration, tier 1, tier 2. They're one day different, and also limits the number of hours a student can take during priority registration to 16. Now, it doesn't mean they've got to stop at 16 forever, but they can only take 16 during the priority registration period. The remaining hours would have to be taken later. The Herald got it exactly right, and I encourage you to actually read that article if your students ask you what's going on. And Policy 10, I can't read my own writing here, help me. Access to electronic personnel file in the Office of Academic Affairs, all those recommendations approved. On the next Tuesday, I'm going to Frankfurt to further develop the Adult Learner Initiative concept. President Ranzer will have a little more to say about that shortly, but that's progressing very well. We hope to have a budget allocation to set it up, and we're actually with DLO already developing what we hope will be the first program to be offered in this modular, competency-based mode aimed at the adult learner population. In terms of the staffing plan, phase one of the staffing plan, there are, I believe, a total of $2.5 million worth of searches authorized. There's a little bit of reserve I held back, about $1.5 million for phase two or whatever comes next. And again, I think when you hear from President Ransdell what's happening, you'll understand why I think it's prudent to save just a little bit of that back so we can address, if necessary, compensation issues with that pool. I hold in my hand the second draft of our SACS compliance report. This is getting much better. I'm very happy with this going. A lot of people are involved in this, and I thank you all for doing so. We are having that internally reviewed again, and then during the early spring, we'll have it externally reviewed. And by that time, it will be a website very similar to what the actual off-site SACS review team will be looking at. I'm very comfortable that we are, in fact, in compliance with all 83, I believe, is standards. It's just a matter of making this absolutely clear and transparent to an outside reviewer. And if someone asks you for data or any information to help with this report, we'd appreciate it greatly if that could be provided. And last but definitely not least, we submitted to the CPE for its 45-day window of other institutional comment, WKU's fourth doctoral program, a professional doctoral program, and a doctor of folklore practice in the Potter College of Arts and Letters. I believe that program will be coming to this body in due course. While that's happening, we send it to CPE for preliminary review, and it all comes together, we hope, by the end of the semester where we can present this to the board and move on. That's my report. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Emsley. We do have with us, of course, Dr. Ransdell. President Ransdell is a guest today speaking about the higher education budget model, and hopefully you found that packet online a little bit earlier for a chance to review. We also have some copies on the tables for you to peruse as we go through this. Just a reminder on this, we do have a Q&A session that is scheduled with Dr. Ransdell on November the 7th. That's going to be at 3:45, special session of the Senate, 3:45 in Snell Hall, 1108. And so for this particular meeting, Dr. Ransdell will make his presentation, and in order for us to be able to get through our business today, we're going to withhold questions and comments today. So if you have questions and comments today, if you would please write those down, save those, and bring those with you then to that November 7th special session, Q&A session, so that we'll have time to address all of those issues at that time. So once again, if you have any questions, please write those down and save those for that November 7th date. So Dr. Ranzo, we will turn it over to you.
Great. Thank you, Mark. Did everybody get this handout? Because I know this may be difficult for some of you to see. That's why I brought paper copies in case you couldn't see the actual audiovisual. Thank you. Thank you. Margaret and I have been talking about some time ago. We talked about the higher ed funding model that is still being developed, but I can share with you today at least where it stands right now. And this will go to CPE in early November for final approval, and then submit it on to the governor's office to hopefully find a way into the governor's budget that he will present to the General Assembly in January. And then the budget will go to the House, go to the Senate. They'll come back in conference, finish it up, and we'll see what we have from there. But the presidents have been putting a lot, chief academic officers, chief budget officers, Gordon and Ann are both here, have been putting a lot of work into this model. And, you know, this is this process gets a little crazy sometimes because you try to arrive at something that eight universities and the Kentucky Community and Technical College system – can try to agree on, and trying to get eight universities and a community college system to agree on something is sometimes a bit of a challenge. But we are fairly close on having a document that we've all contributed to. There are parts of it I don't like, parts of it that some other campuses don't like, but we'll go through some of that. I just thought it'd be helpful for this body to understand what goes into the higher ed funding model and what's in it for us if this gets funded. And I've underlined big if, because we're requesting something over $100 million for higher education, and we're not going to get that. So right now, where we are right now in this budgeting process, the next step is for us to try to achieve agreement on what are the priorities if we only get $20 million, or if we only get $10 million or $30 million. What are the priorities within these variables that will put that money toward? And that's going to be a real battle between us to try to determine what that prioritization will be. And then there will be what's called a consensus document where all the presidents are asked to sign that we support the model, so that we're all going to the General Assembly with one message: support the model, rather than going to them for our own needs and our own specific requests. And that's a better and more politically prudent process to follow. Now, I've made it clear that I'm not going to sign a consensus document until I know what the prioritization is, because I don't think we're going to get what we're asking for. We're going to get a smaller number if we get anything. And so I want to know what's a smaller number going to go to within the things we're asking for, because some of them are a whole lot more important to us than others. So before I sign a consensus document, I need to know what the prioritization are. The second page is just a table of contents of what you have here, but let's go on to this page right here. These are the categories in this funding model. And this is a little bit fluid. These could still change, but I don't think they'll change much. And areas that I do think might still have some change in them, I'll point out to you. But these are the various categories of the funding model, and I'm going to go through each of them for you so that you have each of them in some context. And at the end, I'm going to tell you what we've submitted as our priorities within what you see on this list right here. But the first category, not necessarily in rank order, but this is just how the model was developed: a college and career readiness pool. This is in line with some legislative priorities that have to do with institutions' ability to work with the public schools to put the public schools in a better position to send us students that are college ready. One of the things this state is pretty weak on is getting students in a position where they're ready to pursue a rigorous higher education curriculum. And so the state, we're going to ask the state to invest some money and to help us get students, help us, help the schools better prepare students that come to us. The dynamics that shape this distribution are based on the number of teachers we put into the public schools, the degree to which we're already working with the public schools to help them with their curricula, different ways in which we're already engaged, and there's also a measure of underserved counties within a given institution's primary service area. So a lot of variables went into determining how this distribution is shaped. Now, the good news in this is we get the highest distribution of any of the universities in the state in this particular pool. The bad news is that money's restricted, and it can only be used for the things that are designated in the definitions of this career, college, and readiness pool. We can't use money in this pool, for example, for salaries or for utilities or for whatever the case might be, library journals or faculty promotions or whatever. It has to be used for the things designated in this particular funding category. But if it gets funded at the amount requested, $18.4 million, we'll get $2.2 million of that. So just that you see how we stand with the other campuses. Research and economic development, I'm not real happy about this one, but you know, you choose your battles carefully when you get into these negotiations, and so there is a research dynamic aimed at UK and U of L to help fund their research agendas, and that's a total of $15 million divided two-thirds to UK and one-third to U of L. We won't spend a whole lot of time on that one. The degree production pool in my opinion, is the most important part of this model. I'm going to speak to one other thing in a minute, but it's not part of this particular model. The degree production pool is the performance funding variable in this model. And the General Assembly is pretty focused on making sure that we've got a performance funding variable that is a significant part of the higher ed funding model. And this is it, and the performance is based on degree production. Degree production on a three-year rolling average, the last 3 years, and the pool is $15 million the first year and $30 million the second year, so a total of $30 million over the biennium. And so you take $30 million and the number of degrees awarded by all the institutions with the weighting that you see here for associate, baccalaureate, master's, doctoral, professional, and some other three other categories that kind of a negotiation with members of the General Assembly that are important STEM disciplines, low-income student, premium, underrepresented students that factor into this. In the final analysis, the degree production model was then created, and that money is distributed in this manner. We have the third largest number of degrees that we're putting in the workplace. We have the second largest number of undergraduate degrees, but U of L produces a number of graduate degrees considerably more than we do. So this is how, with all the weighting and all the factors gone into play, this is how this money is being distributed if it gets fully funded. The $1.7 million would be in the first year of the biennium, and the second year of the biennium is about double that as it goes to $30 million. This is important because this is unrestricted money. This is money that we can spend however we deem appropriate, and the commitment that I'm making to you today, any penny we get in this particular pool will go toward faculty and staff salaries. Just write it down. Now, that doesn't mean we're going to get it, but what I'm telling you is any unrestricted money we get in a higher ed funding model is going to go to our number one priority, faculty, staff, salary variables, and or benefits. Benefits factor in. We already know we got about $1 million variable in the budget that's going forward next year that actually starts on January 1 for increasing our benefits package. I'll touch on that more in a little bit. But the degree production model is unrestricted money. That's why we place it very high on our priority list of if there's less money, fund that first. A next variable is the Kentucky Adult Learner element. The provost spoke about that. We are very interested in this because we will be a key player in it, given our experience in distance learning, given what we're doing through DLO, given our faculty engagement in distance learning modules already. This will mostly be an online learning variable, although not entirely. There will probably be three or four selected degree programs that will either be created or already exist that three or four institutions will deliver in this model, and we will be one of those. So whatever gets funded in this, and it won't be a... Whoa, what happened here? Jeff, help me out. Did I press something? Go back to page 7 is where we are. At any rate... So we're interested in this pool. It won't be a lot of money. It'll be a couple million dollars. But we hope to get some of that to further whatever our segment of that be, and it will probably be something that will involve more than one college. Any thoughts on that, Gordon?
Let me elaborate on that a little bit. Eventually, this pool will be probably used to provide scholarships to adult learners to enable them to, you know, do courses and reduce the cost. For this biennium, it will be used to develop programs at the rate of $7,500 per 3-credit-hour course. So if we get a program in this mode at this university, and I strongly believe we will, we'll get $150,000. Yeah, $150,000 to develop a 60-credit-hour competency-based, modularized program. About $1 million of that 2.4 will be used for marketing it. We don't have to market it ourselves. The state will. Professional development for faculty and other members of the team, instructional design and so forth. And that will, in fact, I believe, Gary, be double that in 15-16. I think they're going to actually put another 2.4 in on top of that.
So there'll be a total of $4.8 million available over the two-year period, and we expect to get a pretty good chunk of that. It will go into faculty overload, additional compensation, because it's through DLO, just consistent with the workload policy. Any faculty member participating in this will do this outside of effort and get extra compensation for doing so.
Now keep in mind, when he says we'll be available, you always have to follow that with "we hope." So this is the model. This is the request. This is not an appropriation. But without a model, we have no chance. We just can't go there, you know, send us money. But this is something that we've been tracking very closely. And frankly, we've been very involved in the creation of this whole Adult Learner Initiative. And the provost has been, in fact, he's all but chaired this effort. So it's something that we are tracking very closely. There will be one element in the component that UK and Kentucky State kind of fought hard for, and I finally threw in the towel on this one, that would provide a dynamic of funding for their land grant mission, which has to match with what money they get from the federal government. In the state, the institution has to match, and they've not been getting funding to do that for a while. And so at any rate, it's not a lot of money, but it just continues to add to the total that we're requesting, which makes it more and more of a challenge. So that's a land grant variable in the mix. There will probably be the Bucks for Brains variable will get funded. This is the state matching money for private gifts for faculty, chairs, professorships, endowed faculty positions. Although the last time this money was made available, it was loosened up a little bit to also match funding for scholarships and actually university or private funds that were put into research space for faculty. This is the distribution. The distribution was set by statute back in 1998 in higher ed reform legislation. Wasn't real happy about it then, but at least we do get something out of this. If this gets funded, we would get $3.6 million that would have to be matched by private gifts, as I just described. This would not be an appropriation of $90 million. This would be bonded. So, it would take probably $6 or $7 million to bond $90 million if this gets funded, is how that would likely be paid for. So we're getting down to the parts of the model that probably are long shot, but nevertheless they will be in the model. A late addition was to bow to KCTCS, since they were not sharing in any of the Bucks for Brains concept. A workforce development match program that they would have to match private gifts to KCTCS. All right, the operating request summary. What's in it for WKU? The College and Career Readiness Pool, you see the number there. Research and Economic Development, nothing. Degree Productivity, 1.7 in the first year, 3.4 in the second year. The Adult Learner Initiative, to be determined, but would probably be $500,000 to $1 million to help us fund whatever it is we would be doing, and we have some sense of what that degree program would likely be. Nothing in the land grant fund. So if this entire model would get funded, you can see what we get in the first year and in the second year of the biennium. So you can get some sense of what would be in it for us. And again, the top category would be restricted, and the degree production pool would be unrestricted, and anything we would get in the Bucks for Brains funding would be a direct match to the private gift that created that endowed faculty position or scholarship in the first place. Now, I want to talk about the retirement systems. One of the things that we know that is already on our must-do list is an increase in our obligation in the Kentucky Employees Retirement System, and our hit next year will be $2.1 million. Last year was $800,000. Next year it'll be $2.1 million. And what we will have to pay, what we will be mandated to pay, to participate in the Kentucky Employees Retirement System. And that's because the rate is going up from 26.79% to 38.41% and 38.8% in the first and second year of the biennium. So a big hit the first year, not so much the second year. Now, we are appealing to the governor's office and to the state budget office to try to include this money, and this also affects the comprehensive universities across the state. This does not affect U of L. They were a private university. They pay for their own pension fund, and UK is set up differently as well. So this affects the comprehensive universities in varying amounts. And so we're appealing to the state budget that this be included in the state budget as part of pension reform, which was addressed the last legislative session. About $100 million was identified to shore up the pension systems, and we're appealing that funding for these mandated increases be part of that solution as a fixed cost increase in pension reform. Well, that hadn't been approved yet. It's under review. It's being studied. Failing that, then our number one priority in this budget model is to fund this KERS mandate, because that's $2 million that we can't spend on salaries if we have to pay for this. If we get this funded, any way it's covered, that's $2 million we can put to salaries. And so it's just a straight-up trade for us in that regard. We have no choice but to spend it, but if we can get it covered, we'll otherwise, we'll have to include this in our list of fixed cost increases with whatever tuition increase we might get, which will probably mean that our fixed cost increases would probably exceed what we're likely to generate from a tuition increase. So this becomes a very important $2 million dynamic for us right out of the gate in the first year of the biennium. So here are our priorities. This is what we turned in about a week ago as our priorities in this funding model. In other words, if we get less than the total request, and if we're going to get money, it's going to be less than the total request. If I had to predict, I would say we probably will, you know, somewhere between $15 and $30 million, if I had to guess, for all of higher education. So how's that money? This is what we listed as our priority, and the reason we listed it, as I just explained, the KER's mandated increase, the degree production funds because it's unrestricted, the Adult Learner Initiative because we'll get a large share of that, the College Readiness Pool, even though we get the largest amount of any other institution, and it's important, but it doesn't help us fund our highest priorities. So that's why we downgraded it in our priority list, then Bucks for Brains, because we do get something out of that. We get nothing out of the last two. So obviously they would be our lowest priorities. Now, what will happen is every institution is submitting a similar prioritization, and so then we'll fight it out and determine what a consensus might be. And if we're satisfied that prioritization is in our best interest, then I will likely sign a consensus document in support of the budget model. If we're not, then I may not. The other variable that I'm most concerned about in this higher ed funding model is the fact that we requested an equity pool, and I'm going to talk about that in a minute as to why an equity pool is important, and that didn't get very far. Northern Kentucky was fighting for that also, but they dug in their heels and said all or nothing, and they kind of ended up killing that discussion. But I'm most concerned that we're watching our state funding per student continue to drop, and we're having to pay for our enrollment growth. Really, our students are having to pay for that enrollment growth with increasing tuition. And nothing in this model addresses that. And I'm very concerned about that, and we'll be pressing for a new higher ed funding model in the future that addresses the growing inequity among the institutions in state funding per student. And we'll have more chances to talk about that in the future. But let me go to the capital request. The second part of the budget is capital improvements, brick and mortar, construction, deferred maintenance across all of higher education. And this model requests $600 million for a pool of funds for the campuses to use for capital projects. 53% of it for asset preservation, which means capital renewal, deferred maintenance, and improving to existing facilities. new and expanded space, $280 million. And then an information technology pool of $60 million. This would be a bonded pool. It's projected to cost the state between $50 and $55 million to fund the bond to provide this request. And now the good news on this request is that we would get a little over $70 million of this $600 million pool, right at 12%, based on a whole range of factors: the condition of our physical plants, the volume in our physical plant, our total student population, how many students we have to serve with our physical plant, our current share of the higher ed budget. A very complex formula, but a fair formula that all the campuses have agreed to. And so the beauty of this is we're requesting a $600 million capital pool. All of us are requesting the same thing. Heretofore, we've gone to the general, and the state has not funded capital projects since the 2006 General Assembly, by the way. There's a lot of pent-up need across all of our campuses. And I might add to that that all of our capital construction for the last dozen years, about $600 million, the state's only paid for about 20% of that. We and leases and other financing, Student Life Foundation and other variables have paid for most of our capital improvements on our campuses. We've tried to improve our physical plant. The beauty of this is the campuses will not be going to the General Assembly to fund my project. Don't fund theirs, fund mine. And that's the way it's worked up until now. So this is a much more politically palatable, much more prudent approach. We all know what we get. And if it's something less than $600 million, we all know what percent of that number we would get. If it's $500 million, $400 million, $300 million, we know we're going to get 12% of that. We also know what we can spend for asset preservation or for new construction. And the beauty of it is our number one priority, and we've said it as long as it's been out there since 2006, is the renovation of the center wing of Thompson Complex. We've got to finish up our science, the transformation of our science facilities, and that's the last remaining project in completing a rebuilding of our science facilities. It's a $48 million project to renovate the center wing and then raise the north wing following that. And that really falls into both categories. It's capital renewal, but it could also be considered new construction. So we can pull from both sides of our funding dynamic to do our number one priority. And that's what I hope to get funded one way or another, is to finally complete our science renovation agenda, and that's been about a five-phase process, really, over the last 16 years. So just so you know, that's how the capital dynamic in this funding model works. Okay, I want to go back a little bit to what I was talking about a minute ago in terms of what's got to change in the higher ed funding process. Look at this chart. This chart tells a very complex but a very important story. We have watched our state funding per student, and actually when I started as president, it was around $7,500. In 2000, 2001, $6,700 per student in our state funding. And all the universities were within a range of $1,000 or so of each other in state funding per student. What has happened? We've grown. Other institutions haven't grown. Institutions that have not grown have been able to keep their state funding per student at about the same level. Those institutions that have grown the most have watched their state funding per student continue to drop to where last year it was $4,500. Now, what's that caused? This is the tuition that our students have paid per student per year. And we've watched our tuition grow disproportionately, but in direct proportion to the reduction in state funding per student. At the same time, we've also been able to be highly productive in a growing number of degrees. We've gone from graduating 2,400 students a year to over 4,000 students a year. So we've responded to the state's challenge, the state's mandate in higher ed reform back in 1998 to grow. You've got to grow your number of students and you got to grow your degrees. We've done that. We've gone from 14,500 to 21,000 students, and we've grown our degree productivity from 2,400 to 4,000. We've done everything the state has asked of us, and the state simply has been unable to fund that growth and live up to their end of the bargain. So that's why, after this model is over, in fact, a couple of us, particularly the president at Northern Kentucky University and I, are pushing to go on and start creating a new funding model now that would be ready for the 2016 to 2018 biennial budget process that takes all the money devoted to higher education, of which at one time was about $1.1 billion, now it's about 900 and something million, because of the something well over $100 million in budget cuts since 2008. We've experienced $15 million in budget cuts since 2008. Take the entire pool of funds devoted to higher education, plus whatever we might be requesting in that biennium, and appropriate it proportionately to where we can get back to an equitable state funding per student model. Now, if you think about that, that's going to be a very difficult thing to achieve because you're redistributing the base. But it's got to be done. This pattern, and especially this pattern, can no longer continue. This is the total cost per degree. Now, what's good news about how we're operating at WKU? We've been able to actually control our cost per degree pretty well. It was going up here. But since 2008, we've been able to control our cost of degree. Now, unfortunately, some of that's due to budget cuts. But this is what we're spending per degree that we produce. This is what our students are paying, and this is what the state is paying per degree. That's a pretty scary chart right there. That gap cannot continue to widen, and we got to do everything we possibly can to try to at least get these lines running parallel, if not getting back closer together. The president at, well, I won't say which one of the other universities, when we were beginning to debate this a little bit on a conference call a couple weeks ago, said, well, will you reduce tuition if this kind of model goes forward? And I didn't have a ready answer. I said, well, maybe the rate of tuition increase. But the more I thought about it, and the next time we talk, my response to him is going to be, yeah, if I had the same funding per student that you get, you bet we'd drop tuition. Because he's getting about twice what we're getting per student because they haven't grown much over the last 15 years. So this is a really important discussion going forward, and you know, I don't want to get out in front of it too much because this will take a year or two to negotiate and unfold, and it's going to be probably pretty messy. But it's important that you all know what our priorities will be, not only in this model, but what they will be going forward. And these last two charts are why it's important. Switching gears here just a little bit, health insurance, you all are, I think, pretty well up to speed on what we're doing with our health insurance program. This page shows you what our self-insured medical plan costs and how those costs are covered in terms of university contributions, employee contributions, and then what the fund actually pays for in fund deductions and what our reserve fund is and the challenge we'll have to continue to cover our self-funded health insurance program going forward. This is the university-funded contribution, and we've already made the decision to increase it to $525 per employee Starting January 1, our health insurance plan is on a January 1 to December 1 calendar year, whereas our budget is on a fiscal year basis, July 1 to June 30. So anytime we raise our university contribution, we have to pay for it partially in the year we're in before it gets fully funded for the second 6 months in the next year's budget. But this is about $1 million. That growth from 471 to 521 is about $1 million item that we will have to build into next year's budget, our campus budget, and we'll fund it this year out of non-recurring carry-forward monies that are in our budget. So we'll fund it this year with one-time money, but we got to fund the full cost of it in next year's budget. So that's going to be one of our fixed cost increases right off the top that we will have to cover, that we've made the commitment to fund. And I believe you just got notice today of the open enrollment period, so I do have a chart with me, but there will be some increases across the board on family plans and employee, the premium that the employee pays for spouse or others that you're covering. But we will continue to keep the variable of at least one of our plans that are no cost for the employee. And that's a pretty rare circumstance these days in benefits plans for large employers. We don't know yet exactly what the Affordable Care Act will cost us, but it will cost us, and it will cost our employees some money, and there won't be any benefits for us because we're not participating, but we are going to have costs that we will incur. We got to be very careful because there are some taxes that you pay if you get too rich with your employees, and some penalties that you pay if it's not enough. And so we got to track that very closely to minimize the hit we will take to pay the overall cost of that program nationwide that even employers that don't participate will have to pay. And so we're keeping a close eye on that, but just wanted you to be aware of the priority that our benefits program continues to play in our health insurance coverage. And it's still a much richer plan and a better plan and a less expensive plan than if we participated in the state program or what you find a lot of employers having to deal with these days, particularly smaller corporations and organizations. So that's a pretty quick run through of the state funding model and a couple other things looking forward that I thought would be important to share with you. I know you've got a busy agenda today, but I do look forward to coming back in November and having just a wide open Q&A session on this, on our university budget, on anything else that might be on your mind in general, and I hope everybody can do that in Snell Hall Room. What?
1108.
There you go, 1108. So put that on your calendar. I look forward to having that conversation with you. But I felt like it. Now, one important thing. This has not been finalized yet. These numbers are still fluid. In fact, the degree production number may go up and the research number for UK-UofL may go down in order to put a little bit more money in the degree production model and add a variable that would be called cost of instruction. Some campuses pay more in faculty salaries than other campuses and so forth. We're about third behind UK and UofL in that particular category. Northern may have one category of faculty that might be higher than us. But at any rate, we would benefit slightly if we take, say, $3 million in each year of the biennium and put it from the research pool into the degree productivity pool. So we'll be for that. It wouldn't be a lot of money for us, but it might get us a little higher percentage. We're 11.6%. It might get us 11.8%, 11.9% of the total pool. So, you know, I won't argue over that one. So we'll see how that one unfolds. So this is all still very tentative. In fact, it's not been made public yet. I'm probably taking some risk by getting out in front on it. But I'm pretty sure that the campuses are about ready to move forward with it, and we've got to get it to the state budget office in just a couple of weeks anyway. So hope that's helpful to you. Appreciate your attention on that, and we will keep you posted. Thank you.
Thanks.
thanks to Dr. Ransdell. I'm sure that we will have some good feedback for you as well on November 7th. And if you are unable to make that November 7th meeting and have some questions or comments, if you want to email those to me, that's fine. I can ask those for you, pass those along for you. Or if you want to share those with your alternate or with somebody else on Senate, then please feel free to do that as well. Any questions or comments that you have for President Ransdell? Again, it's November 7th that we will have that special session. Moving along on our agenda in advisory, we've got Regent Patty Minter. You got a report for us today?
Just a real quick question for the President. If any of these variables in this report change between now and the 7th, can you update anything for us? Or you think it's going to be solid? You think this is it between now and the 7th?
No. I think, as I suggested, I think there would be some trade-offs on the research and building the degree productivity. I think there would probably be $3 million each year of the Banium. That's the only thing I see being negotiated right now. I just had that conversation with Bob King yesterday, so
okay.
That's probably the only one that I see changing.
Okay, excellent. Thank you. Very quickly, the Board of Regents is having the fourth quarterly board meeting a week from tomorrow, which is Friday, the 25th of October, gavel to order at 8 a.m. Just got the agenda this morning. It should be posting publicly tomorrow morning. And I will keep you posted about that meeting. Thank you very much for the responses that you've been sending to my faculty regent report. And absolutely keep your questions, comments, anything that you want to talk about coming. I love that give and take, and that way I can always best represent your views. So thank you very much. And again, let me know if you've got any concerns about anything that's going on right now. And I guess that can include this document as well, because I certainly need to know what you're thinking about that. I just wanted to say, please, please, please do come to the special called meeting of the Senate on the 7th, because shared governance works when this is a participatory democracy. So if we don't come and we don't talk this through, express concerns, ask questions, bring the concerns and questions of our constituents, then, you know, we've abrogated our part of the process. So please, please, please do come and attend that, and any other fora that might happen on benefits or AAUP or anything else. We need people to come and engage in the dialogue, and that's how governance works best. So I'll have more after the meeting.
Patty, you mentioned forums. Thank you. I think there are two forums scheduled on the open enrollment for benefits that are, and I don't have, but you should have gotten an email, I think, just today about that. Those would be very helpful. And
absolutely.
I would encourage all faculty
absolutely.
To participate in those.
That's right, because this is, I was just giving a talk at another university last night, and we were talking about insurance and benefits issues, and one of the things I was saying is this is our plan. You know, our plan means our plan, so we need to come and talk about it and ask questions and own it. So, absolutely. I look forward to seeing all of you there.
All right. Thanks very much. And moving on to our SGA president, Kiana Boca.
Thank you. Hello, everyone. I have a few things to report. Recently, Student Government Association passed an amendment in support of amending the university internet usage policies. The FIRE, Freedom of Speech and Freedom for Individual Rights in Education, also known as FIRE, has deemed a red light for the WKU, meaning our student handbook has at least one policy that both clearly and substantially restricts freedom of speech. And so now that that has been passed, we're going to be working with Howard Bailey and other appropriate administrators to see to those changes. A couple other things. We have expanded our scholarship program to include winter term scholarships this year. These are for non-study abroad courses. So for those faculty that will be teaching winter term classes, I encourage you all to let your students know that that application will be up in the next couple weeks on our website, and then they can apply for that funding. Also, we have a new program called the Society of Distinguished Graduates. It's fairly recent and new, and it's basically for students, seniors, graduating seniors, to be nominated by a faculty member or department head or dean based on something that they have done outside of their academic record. So far as like research, international reach, there's many different categories, and it's very, very broad. So anything that they've done that's profound or creative, we encourage you all to apply. 6 students will be selected, and the nomination form will also be on our website. So that's all. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Moving on to our standing committee reports and recommendations, we have a report from Graduate Council. Can I get a motion for approval on that report? Okay. And a second. Is there any information on that, please? Information discussion. Thank you very much. Did you want to comment on that? Yeah, sorry.
Normally the committee chair moves it.
Oh, so that's fine. Yeah, go ahead.
I move for approval of the September 12th Graduate Council agenda.
And remember, this is graduate faculty only, please. Okay, thank you very much. All right, and any discussion on that? I just wanted to put one piece of information in that, which is that the graduate credentials policy that had previously been in front of the Senate that had not been passed yet by the Graduate Council, that was last meeting. We had removed that from the Senate agenda at the last meeting. That is under this Graduate Council report, so that is within this report. Okay, any further discussion? All right. All those in favor of approval, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. And that is approved. Okay. Moving on to the University Curriculum Committee report.
Move to approve the items on the UCC.
Okay. Is there any discussion on that? Okay. And all those in favor of approval, please say aye. And any opposed? Okay, UCC. Yes. I apologize. Yes, I'm just moving through the things that I could click. Yes, there was a proposed change, and this is just a minor change, I guess, to the Graduate Council report, having a division into policy and non-policy items. Dr. Emsley had proposed this in an SEC meeting. SEC then approved that, voted on that. So, Dr. Emsley, if you want to just mention briefly the reason for that.
Well, yeah, the Graduate Council report hitherto has been a kind of mix of course matters and policy matters, and this is in the interest of not holding up approval of the entire report so that, for example, policy matters I may need to discuss with CAD or other groups, and this allows me to send one of the reports through and get the courses scheduled while the other may take more time. So I just felt it was more efficient overall to separate these into two.
Okay, is there any discussion on this? Can I get a motion for approval of that change?
Second.
All right. And again, any discussion on that? All right. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. Moving on to our general education report. Lauren, if you would like to go ahead and just make a motion for approval of that. Is there any discussion on this? Okay. I can pull that up, since I didn't pull that up for you. All right, and all those in favor of that, please say aye. Any opposed? Okay, and that report is approved. Moving on, we didn't have any old business, new business either, unless there's anyone aware of any new business that I did not have on the agenda. We have several information items, and the largest of which we actually have first. We've got guests with us today. We also have our Benefits Committee members, I believe. Could our Benefits Committee senators please raise their hands if you're present today, just to kind of everybody make you aware of where you are here. And then we've also invited Klaus Ernst in to talk to us today about benefits. So if you would like to come forward, if you've got I've got the report online if you just want me to pull that up. Oh, okay. Okay. Well, hopefully this will come up for me. Well, I may not be able to get this to come up for me. Have you got it on a pen drive too? Okay.
Thank you.
Let me go ahead and pull this up in a second. Okay. Oh, I just found his drive though. So we're good. Yeah.
We can move into insurance.
That's
an option. It's the cheapest option.
So this one right here, cost sharing handout.
You know, drive Judge Richard's passes, drive everybody else's passes, say, look, we got to get those stretches out of here. On this Capital One, that's one argument. The other argument is, we don't want to have a decision.
Okay, my apologies, we're ready to roll now, so I will turn it over.
Thanks, Margaret. I'm giving this presentation on benefits, even so I'm not a current Senate member, but I'm probably the faculty member who has the longest service record on this committee, and that's why I'm talking. And so what you see here in that first slide is the benefits costs since we have been with Anthem, and they're basically the blue line, this is WKU's contribution. The next line is the employee contribution. And then you see there's a third line in slight green color, which is the additional costs which employees pay. So what are those? Those are deductibles, co-payments, co-insurance, whatever it may be. And so when the president says we still have a free plan, then he ignores whatever the green line is, and that actually is significant. What you see there at the bottom, this is basically representing the surplus or deficit which we have accumulated over the years. You can see that this line fluctuates quite a bit. Why is that? Well, it's essentially because our overall size of the pool, we have roughly about 2,000 employees, a little over 3,000 employees and dependents, and that's simply not large enough to basically level this out. And so we will always have some fluctuation. As far as I can see, there's nothing unusual going on here. So we're not having any particular bad year such that we have a deficit of, it's going to be somewhere between 1.5 and 2 million in this calendar year. This was expected, and it's simply a fact of medical inflation, which is always higher than regular inflation. And we haven't any increases in cost in 2013. So the WKU contribution and employee contributions have remained constant. In this next graph, what you see is if you set essentially whatever happened there in 2003 as 100%, then this is giving you the percentage increase in cost. And all what this is really trying to show you is that employee contributions to premiums have risen faster than the WKU contribution has risen. This becomes even more convoluted if you take into account the cost which you pay through co-payment and co-insurance and so forth. And so roughly what you should look at, if you look at this top line, that is as a percentage the actual cost employees pay. And so if I were to summarize this up, how much an employee is paying versus the institution, it's roughly 2/3 to 1/3. Okay, keep that in mind with what I'm telling you what will happen in 2014. So it's roughly 2/3 to 1/3. Okay? You should also keep in mind that when you look at such numbers, that of course the if you have a catastrophic event, then you're not paying 1/3, right? You're paying a lot smaller percentage. And also, if you have dependent plans, then you're not just paying 1/3, you're paying a much larger percentage because your contribution is much higher. And so what this says, if you have routine medical things, then you're paying a lot more than 1/3. If you have dependents, then you're paying a lot more than 1/3. If you wanted to look at the last complete plan year, roughly what kind of ballpark figures are we talking about? Employee contributions is about 11.7 million. Employee premiums, about 3.2 million. And co-payments deductibles, about 2.4 million. I don't think this will change much for this year because everything has remained constant. The medical cost is the incurred medical cost in 2012. This, of course, will go up significantly. The prescription is 3.8 million, and the plan resulted in a deficit in 2012 of about 150,000. To just put this in perspective, okay, we didn't know if we're going to have a surplus or a deficit till actually December was over. So if I would look at 2013, we have data up to the end of August. There's a month in January when we gained, we made a plus of 400,000, and then there has been another month when we lost 500,000. And so what that tells you is the costs from months to months, they're not stable. They can fluctuate by about 1 million. Okay? And so we will not know how much we will lose this year till the year's practically over. Again, there's nothing unusual here. Okay? This is just the way business happens, because you just need to imagine that you have a number of high cost cases coming together in a month, then you lose a lot that month. If you're lucky, then you don't lose anything in a month. All the other things, dental, eye, mental, wellness, they're all listed separately. I have not included them in the summary because they're small. Okay, so these items, for example, may be around 150,000, which in the overall scheme doesn't rate. How do we compare with benchmarks? Well, there has been a study done in 2010 by HR, and that's still the last known complete study on this issue, and in 2010, we were well below. So here I just have listed a couple things which would come out of this study. And since you know, since 2010, things have not changed significantly, we're still well below. So this gap, if anything, has widened. It has not closed. One of the things you may want to consider is that many, many of our benchmark institutions and other comparable institutions have a variable contribution. What does that mean? Well, you know that when you select your insurance, you select a tier, single, employee, spouse, employee, child, or family. That's called a tier. And a variable contribution would work something like this. The employer pays a fixed percentage of whatever plan you select. Okay? Which means if you have dependents, you get more from the institution than if you don't. But that's called a variable contribution, and that's a very common model. Going forward, as far as this body is concerned, there's nothing you can do for 2014. Actually, if you check your email today, all the details were released, so they're now public in terms of what will happen in 2014. And so I will just give you sort of a couple of items you may want to consider when you're looking forward into the future. So if we were doing nothing, as you see on this very first slide I had up there, we were predicting a loss of somewhere between 1.5 and 2 million for this calendar year. If we did nothing due to medical inflation, we would lose that money plus roughly 10% of our business. And so our business, if it's around 14, 15 million, you would have to add 1.5 million to that. So we would lose somewhere at least 3 million, maybe up to 4 million. All of you know is that we have a reserve, and this reserve containing about 4.25 million. Now, the reserve is money which we have for several reasons. If for whatever reason we would get out of the self-insurance business, then we still have medical claims coming in, which will have to be paid. So an estimate is that we roughly need 25% of our annual medical business as a reserve to pay claims, which are run-out claims. Because if we were going to join any other plan or become fully insured, we would have to pay the new premiums plus these run-out costs. So the actual reserve, which is currently there, which is not restricted by these run-out things, is actually very small. It's only about maybe 1.25 million. And out of this, I would estimate that we lose somewhere around 500,000 to maybe 1 million, depending on how this year ends. And so, going forward, for 2014, we were between a rock and a hard place in the sense that if we have losses exceeding 3 million, we can't pay this out of the reserve. And so, therefore, something had to be done. And there were several rounds of negotiations between the Benefits Committee and the administration, which finally arrived at a compromise which roughly looks like this. The university, you heard the president, will increase the contribution to 525. That's roughly costing the university 1.3 million. And the employees will also contribute roughly 1.3 million. Through what? Well, now it's public, so I can talk about it. There are a couple things which will happen. Basically, the free plan will move from the standard to the economy plan. We have introduced a specialist copay, which will be $50. There's a $50 deductible on your prescription plan. And if you would add up these increases in premiums, the actuarial estimate of the decrease of plan value this represents, then you roughly arrive at also 1.3 million. Now, roughly this is 50-50. Remember what I told you? We are currently looking at two-thirds, one-third. So this will shift not in our favor. So the percentage the employees contribute will increase in 2014. Now, we tried to get the administration to commit new money to the plan last spring, because whatever I'm showing you here is not unexpected. This was predicted. Okay? There's nothing unusual in our medical costs. This is all within the framework of what should happen, what will happen. Okay? And so, at that point, we didn't get new money. Now, eventually, it became clear that we really, really, really needed new money. And so, this money, most of the money from WKU is promised for 2014. For the first 6 months, they want to pay us it with one-time money for the remainder of the year. This is currently unbudgeted. And so this will be money which has to be budgeted. And what you guys could think about, where you could make a contribution, is the fact going forward from here, for 2015, what should happen? Should the plan values be decreased further, or should the administration increase the 525 to some higher number? The first thing anybody will tell you that whatever money you commit one way is not available for another way, right? And so there are winners and losers. I mean, it's very clear that if I have a very high salary, if I get a percentage raise in my salary, I'm better off versus an insurance rate increase. Versus a contribution increase. If I have a low salary, I can do the opposite. I think that we as a faculty really, really have to think about the following. If we want to hire a new assistant professor faculty person, and this person has a family, where are we? Are we losing competitiveness in the marketplace by somebody who has to pay $600 a month for family coverage? I think we're very close to that. And so this is some things you guys need to think about. If the Senate wants to weigh in, the Senate wants to make a contribution to how our plans develop going forward. If nothing is done, then we will have no choice but to decrease plan volume further, okay, or raise premiums. And so whatever happens, the choices are not going to be pleasant. One last comment, and some of you may not know that. Self-insurance. Why are we self-insured? Well, for many years, we were fully insured. And the idea of self-insurance is very simple. You incur additional risk, and by doing so, you cut out the profits of the middleman. So currently, we hire Anthem to be our third-party administrator, which means that the network of doctors we have is exactly the same as if we would be fully insured with Anthem. Why do we hire Anthem? Well, because Anthem currently has the steepest discount rates in the state. If you get a statement from your insurance, then it will always say, bill charges X, and then allowed charges Y, and disallowed charges is the remainder. And roughly speaking, whatever they bill and what is allowed, Anthem provides roughly about 50% discount rate. That's why we hire Anthem, and we have actuaries who map this out for different companies when we put this out to bid, and Anthem's rate, when we did that the last time, were the best. Okay? Where does Anthem's profit come in? Well, we pay a flat fee. So for each person who has a contract in our insurance program, we pay a flat fee for Anthem, and that's roughly, I believe, somewhere in order of $1.5 million a year. That's where their profit comes from. I also want you guys to understand the following. If you ever encounter something that you had a doctor for many years, and then they suddenly leave our plan, why does that happen? Well, that happens because they are negotiating for rates with Anthem, and they play a game. Okay? And what is that game? Well, you pay me more, or I drop out of your plan. And whenever you bring this to the attention of the Benefits Committee or to HR, then you should be clear about that we hire Anthem precisely to keep the rates low. Okay? And so we're between a rock and a hard place, and basically there's not much we can do. So, the summary is there's no easy answer. I do not believe that becoming fully insured or joining some other state plan would be an easy answer. The savings which we get by being self-insured have been estimated somewhere around 5% of total volume, so it's not a huge amount. Okay, and these, the logic for being self-insured, as far as I can see, is still valid. I have been on this committee for many, many years. We get reports which track usage, which compares us to other things. Are we anywhere, anyhow unusual? So, for example, do we have many, many more people having surgeries than others? Do we have many, many more people doing this? No. We are just average. Our median age has basically, over the last 10 years, changed very, very little. And so there's nothing surprising here. So to sum it up, the Senate Executive Committee has given this report to the Faculty Welfare Status and Responsibilities Committee. They will bring back some resolutions to the Senate eventually. If the Senate wants to have an impact, this impact needs to be come forward in a timely manner. What does that mean? Well, you heard the President that the budget will be set in the spring for the next academic budget. And so whatever happens with insurance in 2015, that budget will be the budget which will cover the first 6 months of 2015. And so the Senate should really debate, think about, what do you prefer? Money in raises, money in subsidizing health insurance, money for whatever. Okay, there's no easy answer for this. Clearly we can't have it all. But I would welcome, as a faculty member on the Benefits Committee, any political pressure this body can apply to prevent further eroding of our health insurance plan bodies. Thanks.
Just out of curiosity, did you initiate the wellness program? Is that what you're helping?
The wellness program, I have been a long-standing supporter on the wellness program. And why? Because there have been some basic studies done which essentially say the following, that the wellness program pays for itself. Okay? This will be extremely difficult to measure for a group of our small size. But it has been done with whole state employee pools, which are much, much larger set than we are. And so what you're trying to measure is wellness initiatives versus a medical trend. And if you believe these studies, and I believe these studies, I see nothing that tells me that this is an industry something, then these plans will pay for itself in the long run. In the short term, they will not. All of you are aware of that we have an incentives program, and at least this incentive program, initially, you don't have to do much at all, right? And so we're trying to create a wellness culture with the firm belief that it pays for itself. However, in the overall scheme, okay, this total reward money we're going to spend for this year is in the order of, I may be off slightly, but let's say it's less than 200,000, okay, out of a 15 million budget. In terms of percentage, it's minuscule. Okay, so the wellness doesn't impact us in a major cost way, one way or the other. But I do believe these studies that the dollars we spent there are well spent.
Okay. The question I ask is, the research I've read said that the wellness programs cause people to go see their doctor, get a checkup, get tests done, and they finally have these medical problems before you know it. You're spending more money than you would have if you just let them be sick. And I love the wellness program I'm participating in, but from a cost benefit standpoint, everything I just thought was important.
Again, will you find cases like you just described? Yes. I think that you only find the benefit of a wellness program if you look at it on a large scale in the very long run. So yes, you may go to the doctor and you may have some immediate costs, but the problem is, will you offset that 10 years down the road by not having that problem? And so it has to be viewed in a long term. I do not believe that we will be able to come back next year and say we saved that many dollars on our wellness program. That cannot be done. Okay.
I'm a little bit concerned. You mentioned the cost. Being self-employed saves us about 5%.
Self-insured.
Self-insured.
Self-insured, yeah. Being self-insured saves us like 5%. I'm a finance teacher, so I think in terms of risk and return. Okay? And we, from an insurance standpoint, we have small numbers. So if we have some catastrophic illnesses occur to some of our people, then we could be in real trouble here.
Well, yes and no. So I didn't mention that because it's technical. We purchase reinsurance.
Okay.
And so for reinsurance, what that means is we limit an individual case to a certain cap. And if it goes beyond the cap, then insurance will pay for the rest. And that's how we try to minimize the fluctuations. But nevertheless, in the 10 years I have been on this committee, we have seen from one year to the next a decrease in medical cost from 3%, so minus 3%. We also have seen from one year to the next plus 25%. And so, yes, there is a large fluctuation. And that's why it's important that we do have a reserve to dampen that out. And if we're going to draw down the reserve to zero, then we have a big problem. Okay. Now, I do not know whether the 5% going forward is still correct because of the Affordable Care Act basically limits, in some sense, the profit a fully insured program can make. Before, this was simply not the case, right? So if they estimated well and they made a lot of profit in a given year, they could keep it all. They didn't even have to tell us that they did make that profit, right? So these are ballpark estimates which were given to us when we got into the self-insurance business. And I see no reason to believe that they significantly changed.
A little more information. Thanks to my colleagues on the benefits committee. I did that for 11 years. It's a hard job, and you've had a hard year, so thank you very much for your excellent service. As Klaus told you, the SEC has tasked faculty welfare with coming up with a resolution, and I know that they will come up with something that is clear and advocates for our best interests. I've also met with faculty welfare this past Friday and asked them to speak to the issue that the president raised with you just in passing, and he's raised this with me before, about what you do if you have X amount of money and no more. You put it to salary, you put it to benefits. How do you deal with that? So they're going to be advising me on that, and I thank them in advance for all of their guidance and wisdom. I have meetings with the provost and the president next week to talk about these very issues. So if you have something you'd like to say to me, please do so. I'd love to hear from you on email. More information and more input from you is good information. So thank you in advance.
Let me just add one thing where I also would like the Senate to think about. We have been discussing, or there are so-called health care savings plans, right? And that may be one way to go forward to have cheaper plans. What you should be very clear on, if you're 30 and healthy, such a plan is great. If you are 55 and not so healthy, it isn't. Okay, and so going down this route will mean a decrease in overall plan value and a shift of costs from the healthy, lucky ones to the not-so-lucky ones. And again, I would welcome any resolution the Senate may have on any such issue. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
So once again, that is faculty welfare is considering that in further detail, and we'll make some recommendations to Senate about that. Second information item, the SEC at this last meeting approved co-sponsorship, and that's in name only, so that's no money involved, so everybody wanted to make that clear, of an open forum with the WKU chapter, the American Association of University Professors, the AAUP, and so Eric, if you'd like to speak to that.
I won't speak to it since we already have the item up there, but I will say that we just yesterday scheduled it, and it's going to be on, they're going to come visit us from University of Cincinnati on the November 11th and 12th, and I will email everyone once all that scheduling is actually in place.
Okay. Thank you very much. And, yeah, it would be wonderful to have some good faculty representation at those events and to be able to ask questions and learn from what they can bring to us. And in particular, in light of the ideas about changes in faculty governance, it might be very helpful for us to understand what kinds of things are happening at other institutions. So the third item on the list is for faculty governance forums. We do have a faculty governance document that has come from the Ad Hoc Committee on Faculty Governance that is posted under documents on the Senate website, so you can take a look at that. There are three different parts to it. I think there's a timeline, which is very flexible, and so that's getting changed a little bit, and then there's a Senate charter, change in Senate charter, and then there's a proposed change for a new segment. So take a look at that, and you can see what you think about that. But the SEC has approved for that to be posted online, and then for these faculty governance forums to come along. I don't have dates on those or locations on those for you, so I'm checking on some places where we could have those and have some extended campus participation, have them be able to see those forums and then be able to participate in those. So I'm checking on the venues in which we can do that and the availability of those venues to get those forums set up. Now, at the SEC meeting, the contingent of the ad hoc committee that's present at that SEC meeting has stated that, you know, they are completed with the document. So they are, in their mind, they are done with the document at this point. So that means that moving forward, we will probably need to do some work on this in terms of, you know, if there's feedback or anything of that is necessary. So this document is now no longer the property of the ad hoc committee. So perhaps we would want to make sure that we get in place something about the ownership of this document at present. Yes?
I understand the SEC meeting there was a controversy about who owned it, so I'd
like to clarify that. I move that the SEC be the body responsible for any revisions to the report of the Task Force on Faculty Governance. The revisions will take into consideration faculty comments at the public forums and views expressed in the Senate's discussion of the document.
All right. A second on that, please. Is there any discussion on that? Yes.
Yeah, apparently, but we
do you see the possible conflict? Does that mean that we are voluntarily limiting some people that were inputs into that document?
No, because I'm hoping the SEC is going to have it fully debated on the floor.
Absolutely.
But I think what we want to avoid is trying to rewrite it on the floor.
Good.
Where if there's a majority that says we don't like this, then they go back and carry out that revision. Anyway, that's what I'm envisioning.
All right.
So in other words, people need to bring those concerns, comments, edits to the forums.
That's correct. Yes. Yes. So, yeah, any of those forums that happen, the now former ad hoc committee, they are available for answering questions as to, why they may have proposed certain things or done certain things. And so you can certainly ask them questions. I think a number of them plan to be present at some of the forums if they can. And so, yeah, if you have comments, concerns, questions, please bring those to the forums. I'm going to also try, I haven't worked this out yet, but I'm also going to try to have some online setup where people can post, because this is open to faculty. So these are faculty forums, not just a Senate forum, so that people can post their comments and concerns online as well, so that we can gather that information in kind of an easy way. There's also an expectation, because we will definitely need an editing body for this, for things that move forward from both the SEC and the Senate in terms of what gets approved. And so I would imagine that in the near future there will be an editing body appointed, just a small editing body appointed, to be able to accommodate those voted changes or comments, concerns that happen from, like I said, the SEC, the faculty at large, and then the Senate as well. So any other comments about that? Okay. Let's go ahead and vote for approval. So on the motion that is on the floor. So all those in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. So we will go ahead and move forward with SEC and ownership of that. And again, we will have a committee to, or a, well, just a small group of people, contingent of people, to deal with those edits. The last item we have on the agenda today, election results from the last meeting. I'll just pull those up for you. I also emailed those out, and thanks for the reminder, by the way, that those hadn't been emailed. So those were our votes from the last meeting, so you can take a look at those, and they are also posted online. So any questions or concerns about those? Okay. Well, then, thank you very much, and can we get a motion to adjourn?
Second.
And all those in favor, stand up.
Ha ha ha.